Live from the 6th and Peabody Studio and across the OutKick Network, this is OutKick 360 with Jonathan Hutton and Chad Withrow.
Final hour of the Tuesday edition, OutKick 360 rolls on across the OutKick Network. If you're viewing us at OutKick.com, streaming us live there, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, all of that. Plus, if you're listening across the OutKick Network to this great radio partner, we say thank you. Chad, coming up, we've got Billy Lucci of TexAgs.com, the very latest from College Station, just to figure out, like, the vibe on the buyout for Jimbo Fisher and whether or not his tune has changed, Billy's has changed, on if it's possible they would pay upwards of $90 million.
Billy's been very consistent that it's not going to happen, that they're right. It's going to take Jimbo Fisher looking in the mirror and changing things.
Frank Isola joins us, SiriusXM NBA host, plus
one of the best
ESPN contributor. Absolutely. Frank, thank you for the time, man. Hope you're well.
Good. How are you guys doing? Have they built that football stadium in Nashville yet?
You know, they haven't, and I can already see it now, even though it's like 6 years away. So maybe we'll see you there.
It looks like a hotel when you look at the outside of that thing, the rendering for
either
it.
Either that or a Topgolf.
Yeah.
Well, you got something that we don't have in New York. You have a nice soccer stadium, which is pretty cool. So.
Yeah. And maybe we'll get the, championship game or who knows, a Super Bowl. Although it'll be interesting. There's a rule about capacity for a Super Bowl. This one's going to be well below that. It's going to be around 60,000.
Usually the big thing for the Super Bowl, it's like the NBA All-Star game. You need a certain amount of hotel rooms. That's why places like Portland hasn't had the All-Star game. You know, the smaller the city, they won't have it there.
Yeah, Frank, the craziness with the Brooklyn Nets, and we were covering it on the show this offseason.
Really?
About
craziness with the Brooklyn Nets. Okay.
Well, let's start with this. I was surprised Durant came back and came back with Steve Nash. So how did that all go down to where Durant, who's known for just saying, hey, I'm out, came back with the coach he apparently didn't want to play for anymore, and then seven games in, Nash is no longer there. Why did they start the season with Steve Nash?
Well, Kevin Durant coming back was pretty simple. You know, he asked to be traded, and the Nets were smart. They said, sure, we'll trade you. And they made it clear they were only going to trade him for a deal that they thought was good for them. So they were asking for the moon. They called the Boston Celtics up, and they're asking for Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. The Celtics aren't going to do that. So with no other options left, and remember, Kevin Durant had signed a four-year extension with the Brooklyn Nets. So it wasn't like he's entering the last year of his contract, and they're under pressure to get rid of him. And the one thing about Kevin Durant, who does, he's active on Twitter. He might do some wacky things, but he's going to play hard when he's out there, and he's going to play pretty well. So I think the idea was come back, see if you like it here. Maybe at some point, if you still want to go, we'll let you go. But, you know, it's weird because he had a good relationship with Steve Nash. From what I heard, he kind of just said that as leverage, trying to force their hand. But guess what? Steve Nash ended up getting fired. And then when they asked Kevin Durant about it, he said, I'm shocked. And I'm thinking, well, how can you say you're shocked when you're the guy that asked for the guy to be out, unless you're shocked that they actually listened to you? Maybe that's what he was shocked by.
Was Steve Nash really a bad coach, or was this simply a situation that he was never going to be able to win when he took the job with that group?
Well, think about this, right? So if you go back 2 years ago and James Harden had been acquired from the Houston Rockets and they gave up a lot to get him, and Kyrie Irving was healthy and Kevin Durant was Kevin Durant, they beat Boston in five games. That was a gentleman's sweep. They blow out Milwaukee in games one and two of the second round. That's the team that goes on to win the championship. Then what happens? James Harden gets hurt. Kyrie Irving got hurt in game four. And then they end up losing in game seven. And they lost by a toe because Kevin Durant hit a game-tying shot. If his foot is an inch behind the line, they win that game. They play Atlanta. So they were that. When they were doing that, winning six of their first seven playoff games, no one was saying Steve Nash was a bad coach. When Steve Nash became a bad coach is when James Harden shows up out of shape and doesn't want to be there anymore. And then Kyrie Irving with the vaccination status is a part-time player, because at first the Nets didn't even want to play in any games. Then they eventually let him back to play the road games, and Kevin Durant got hurt. Then, yeah, he's not a good coach when he doesn't have his best players. But guess what? That's true of just about every coach in every sport.
Frank Isola with this, SiriusXM NBA radio host, ESPN contributor, and much more. Where did it fall apart with Udoka being the head coach after it was assumed that was going to happen?
Yeah. Well, so Ime Udoka had been a net assistant coach. He was a net assistant coach two seasons ago when they made that run in the playoffs. So he had a relationship there. Obviously, Sean Marks, the general manager, is San Antonio Spurs. You know, the NBA or basketball in general is run by the three families. It's Duke University, it's the Spurs, and it's USA Basketball. It's like the mob families of the of basketball. So they had the connection there. But I think when all this Kyrie Irving stuff, number one, was going down, then all of a sudden they fire Steve Nash and Ime Udoka's name comes up. And I think the league, this is what I believed happened. I don't know it for a fact, but I think the league stepped in and said, hang on a second. How are you going to hire a guy that currently is suspended by one team and now bring him into work for you? And by the way, guys, that was impacting the Boston Celtic locker room. From what I heard, guys like Marcus Smart came out publicly and said it, but I think Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, their position was, wait, so the guy you're telling us he can't coach us, but he can coach one of our rivals? That doesn't make any sense. So that whole thing probably messed up the Boston Celtics more than it did the Brooklyn Nets, believe it or not.
It feels like a lot of things, and this is not just the NBA or the Nets, but organizations kind of akin to the kicker going out if it's windy in football and taking some grass off the ground and tossing it in the air and seeing which way the wind is blowing. I felt like the Udoka situation was a little bit of that, to see how negative the reaction would be once stories were out there that he might get hired. And I think there's some of that going on with Kyrie Irving and the whole situation. Yeah. It seems to be back and forth day to day in terms of reaction. It's not often you get Dave Chappelle joking about your team if you're the Brooklyn Nets in his SNL monologue. How do you view all of this, Frank?
Well, and you're 100% right. I kind of think also the Ime Udoka thing was floated out there like a trial balloon in some respects. You know, the Kyrie Irving thing, you know, so when it happened, and so now it's about 16 days ago, it was that Saturday night when he had the press conference, and he, you know, the whole back and forth with Nick Friedel over putting something on your posting something on social media, does that mean you're promoting it? Of course, in theory, he's promoting it. Who knew about the darn thing before Kyrie Irving tweeted it, and then everyone's kept talking about it? So in theory, that is promotion. But I thought the league kind of dropped the ball, because I think, you know, if David Stern were around, I think David Stern would have met with Kyrie Irving pretty quickly and said, I need you to do this, this, or that, and if you don't do it, you're going to be in big trouble with me. That would have been a very private meeting that would have taken place. And David Stern would have been pretty heavy-handed, and I think it would have ended there. I think, you know, as the days went by, and then Kyrie had the press conference, and then that kind of blew up. The next day, the league came out with a statement. Then they decide to suspend him, and then Kyrie apologized. And now, you know, they set these parameters, which I don't think are outrageous. The one that I think, if I were Kyrie Irving, you know, you're telling me to meet with, do sensitivity training. You want me to apologize. You want me to meet with Jewish leaders. Okay. I got to now give you $500,000. I don't know. It sounds a little bit like extortion. The other ones I could kind of see. And really for him, if he wants to play in another market like LA or Miami, it's not the worst thing to probably do those. The $500,000, that one I'm a little uncomfortable with.
Is it fair or unfair to say David Stern would have done something and then we would have reacted and Adam Silver reacts to the reaction? Is that an overstep?
I think that's pretty fair. I think that's why their statement last Friday, I believe it was, I think it was more about the league telling the public, yes, this is an issue that we care about. Yes, we are addressing it with Kyrie Irving. But again, I just thought he waited way too long. That happened on a Saturday night. I would think even by Sunday or Monday, they just should have met with Kyrie Irving. Guys, remember, I understand the traffic from Brooklyn to New York City sometimes could be a little nutty. There was no reason why they couldn't have met over a day or two. You're not asking the guy to fly in from Memphis, for crying out loud. He was, you know, they were both in New York for a week.
Yeah, and how much of the reaction to the reaction is waiting on LeBron James' reaction in any of these stories? Yeah. How much weight does that carry when he sends out a tweet, either condemning something, embracing it, whatever it may be on any topic? How much weight does that carry?
Well, I would say that LeBron and Chris Paul are the most powerful players in the league. I don't think there's any question about that. But I also think the timing of what LeBron said, where he kind of, at first he waited, then he talked about hate speech, not really mentioned Kyrie's name. Then when he came out and said the punishment was excessive, that was right around the time Jaylen Brown of the Boston Celtics, who happens to be a vice president in the union, said the same thing. So I have a feeling that LeBron, and you know that the union keeps in close contact with LeBron, I think he knew where Adam Silver was going to go. And I think he kind of knew, you know what, it's probably safe for me now to come out and say this stuff and defend Kyrie Irving publicly, because I think deep down he might have been, you know, trying to create a soft landing spot for Kyrie to potentially end on the Lakers. Do I know if that's going to happen? I have no idea, but I think that's, you know, Kyrie wants to go there. I think the Lakers would love nothing more than to trade Russell Westbrook for Kyrie. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I think part of LeBron, you know, LeBron is like that. There's a, you know, there's always, there's an agenda to everything. And part of his agenda is getting Kyrie Irving in L.A. for Russell Westbrook.
Well, he certainly made it known, too. LeBron has about the franchise in Vegas that he wants to be a part of. How close are we to that happening in the NBA?
Well, think about this, right? So the NBA always had something to do with Vegas. They had the Summer League there, which has completely blown up. I mean, it's amazing how many fans go to it. It's become like the NBA summer convention. You'll see everybody from Jerry West to the number one overall pick of the draft will be out in Vegas. So the NBA had the All-Star game there. They had Summer League out there. And then what happened? All these other leagues ended up going. I get it. They have a WNBA team, but to get the hockey team there, and you have obviously football, maybe there's a chance the Oakland A's are going to end up out there. It's going to happen at some point. I don't think there's any question about it. So you mentioned, you know, trial balloons before. I think that's kind of what it was. Maybe get other teams in there first, then the NBA will go. And you guys will love this one. If you talk to NBA people, they think whatever NBA team goes there will have an advantage. Because think about it. Let's say you're playing Denver on a Thursday night. By the time the game ends, you fly to Vegas. Maybe the plane lands at 2, 2:30. The town is still open. And maybe you're playing the next night. So coaches, when they're going, it's just like Miami has an advantage. Atlanta has an advantage in the NBA. New York City, there's an advantage. Vegas is going to have an advantage as well.
You know, coaches are going to be having their team stay out in Henderson or somewhere in the suburbs to try to avoid that.
Not if they want to keep their jobs. Hey, it'll be like Iverson. Iverson used to just leave whatever he had in the hotel room, you know, on these trips. You go to Vegas, every player's doing that.
You know, you know where he went when he played for Philly? He always made the drive to Atlantic City.
I would too.
That's where he was always hanging.
Frank Isola has been our guest. Down the road here, who's the team that you feel like the Lakers? When does the Lakers saga of losing become old for you to continue to discuss on camera? Like, when do you feel like you're repeating the same thing over and over and over, even though I get it, it's LeBron
and it's the Lakers.
It's the Lakers, but man, they're really hard to watch. And it looked like LeBron, the way this is going, it reminds me of like the Patriots last year with Brady, where they were winning, but they really weren't that good. They bowed out to the Titans in the wild card round. Like, you felt like it was over. I feel like we're watching LeBron at the end, but LeBron's talking about playing with his son.
Yeah. Well, you guys know this. I mean, especially where you guys are located, you know, college football, it's about the season and the games. The NFL, it's the same thing. Every game is meaningful. The NBA, the regular season, is all about drama. What do we talk about in the NBA? We joke around about it on my radio show that I do with Brian Scalabrine. We always say halftime of the first game is when we start talking about the MVP conversation. It's unbelievable how that topic in the NBA starts in October and goes the entire year. And then we talk about who's going to make the All-Star team and then all the drama off the court. The Lakers, because it's the Lakers, it's just like the Boston Celtics, you know, you know, the big time traditional franchise. But LeBron he's a compelling guy because he'll always do something or say something that is going to attract people to it. And, you know, listen, with him, we praise him a lot as a player. Some of the things that he says could be a little nutty and a little wacky. His TV show, it's always kind of fun to poke fun at that. So he's compelling from that standpoint. But you're right. I did their game on Saturday night on the Yes Network. The Nets played them. That was pretty rough. Listen, Anthony Davis was good, but they got a lot of no-name guys. That's not James Worthy and Magic Johnson walking through that door. That's for sure.
Not even Kurt Rambis in some certain instances either.
It's more like Smush Parker. Remember when he played for the Nets? That's what it was like.
You just discussing Boston and randomly on the way out here. So you mentioned the players behind the scenes in the locker room there for the Celtics. Like, hey, you're going to let him walk, but he can't coach for us. Do the players there want Udoka to continue to coach there after this year? Like, is the sentiment there like, hey, we want him back, or is it don't let him go for free right now type thing?
I'm sure it is. But, you know, Joe Mazzulla, who, by the way, came to the team with Brad Stevens. So he's kind of a Brad Stevens guy who's running the organization, where a lot of the assistant coaches still there are Ime Udoka guys. So you have that whole dynamic. I can't imagine he's going to coach the team again after this whole thing. And remember, in that his kind of agreement with the Celtics, if he goes somewhere, they can't ask for compensation. So I think the Celtics are thinking, if somebody else takes him, then we don't have to do a buyout with him. I think the players would want him back. I think the players feel like he probably got railroaded, but I doubt it's going to happen.
What's your favorite segment on PTI?
I like when they did the thing where they did what was it called, role play, where they put the face and then they would act like the guys. I thought I never got to do that with them, but when, you know, sometimes they have me dress up, look like an idiot. I just like going down. I like, you know, what's fun about it too? I get to go down to DC and spend some time down there, which is fun.
Yeah. Then the whole crew there is awesome too. 5 good minutes. That's what I would vote for. I like the chats there.
And I'll tell you what, Steve Young, who I did it with him last Thursday, he was really good. He was talking about he would be setting in hand signals, but Joe Montana was actually reading Bill Walsh's lips and knew what plays were coming. Think about that. That's how he said that's how good Montana was. Like, he knew everything that they really wanted as Bill Walsh is mouthing it. It's pretty cool.
These are the stories I'm here for, to hear things like that. This has been terrific, Frank. Thank you so much.
Hey, more talk about the Jets or Giants there.
You know what? It's really more of a giant town.
Okay.
Jets fans. So, you know, the Jet fans are the ones that will fight you. It's more of a giant town. But everyone's pumped up. I mean, both teams have a winning record. Who would have thunk it?
I know. Crazy, man. Hey, appreciate the time. Love the work. And hopefully we'll have you on down the road. Appreciate it.
Thanks, boys. Stay out of trouble in Nashville. Yeah,
we'll try.
Do our best.
We'll
it's not Vegas, but it's
we're
close.
At a distillery. We'll try here. Yeah.
I'll see you guys.
There's Frank Isola, SiriusXM NBA Radio Plus. On ESPN, you'll see him on PTI.
I need to get Frank down here to try some of these moonshine cherries at some point. On the desk in front of me.
You know who has tried them is Billy Lucci. Billy Lucci, TexAgs.com, frequent contributor to the show as well. He's always nice enough to join us and give us insight from College Station on the Aggies.
Just a few things to talk about with the Aggies.
Wow.
Just a few.
What a drop-off. And if not for the 100-yard recovery and return for a touchdown by against Arkansas, we're talking about a 3-win team right now. Billy Lucci from TexAgs joins us next on Outkick 360. Outkick 360 rolls on live in Nashville, 6th and Peabody with Yeehaw Beer, Old Smoky Moonshine. Chad Withrow, I'm Jonathan Hutton, talking football every day, NFL, SEC, and beyond. And it's hard to discuss the SEC and not mention Texas A&M. It was hard during the offseason. We're previewing the 2022 regular season. We're discussing the schedule and, you know, the second best team in the West. And they high accolades no matter where you look. And now, I mean, it's really stunning that they've gone 12 straight games, Chad, A&M, we mentioned this earlier, 12 straight games in FBS without scoring 30 points or more. And you've got, you know, a situation where they open the season 6th in the country, and they currently are not going to a bowl game. That's official after the loss to Auburn. Billy Lucci, always kind enough to join us, owner of TexAgs.com, and I mean, let's face it, he could be the mayor, governor, however you want to describe it, any office he would like to hold.
He's the man guy.
Could hold
he
it.
Is the man.
That's right. And stories for days. We always get a great story. We'll ask him one at the end of this. But the story in College Station are the Aggies and the lack of production. Billy, how are you, man?
I'm good. I wish I was in Tennessee right now. That sounds pretty amazing, especially if y'all give me some of that moonshine.
We'll send you some, man.
We've got some moonshine here for you, Billy, whenever you're ready.
Absolutely.
Man. Come around. Our town is your town when you come in.
Yeah, we owe you a lot more than that. Hey, so we were mentioning this earlier. We felt like last time you joined us, the buyout, it wasn't going to happen, right? Has anything changed in regards to that since the last time you joined us, which was roughly a month ago?
No, nothing's changed. Here's the thing on the buyout. Everybody keeps throwing out that 80-something million, right? It's also north of 100 million when you think of staff. You know, it's not just Jimbo that would go. That buyout is right now, today, would be north of $100 million. And does A&M have that kind of money? Yes and no. I mean, this myth that there are donors that are going to cut a big check and hand it to a guy, they're way more likely. And in fact, it's what's going on from some of the mega donors that I talk to and consider friends, is they're asking Jimbo or Ross Bjork, like saying, what do we need to do to help get Jimbo through this and to the other side? Because they recognize the situation with the contract, and they understand that is a mountain too tall to clear. Because say you're one of these multi-hundred-million billionaire types, you're not going to give. I mean, you're not going to give Jimbo. Somebody's not going to step up and go, yeah, I'll give this guy $40 million to go live in West Virginia and do nothing. They don't get rich that way. And they will give $20 million, $25 million to A&M's football facilities. They will throw support at Jimbo Fisher or Kevin Sumlin or Mike Sherman or Dennis Franchione or R.C. Slow, whoever is sitting in that chair. When they're not going to be sitting in that chair anymore, it makes it a lot – they're a lot less inclined to just hand somebody that much money that's going away and is no longer going to be working at Texas A&M. So, no, I haven't heard anything – going that way. And in fact, I've heard the exact opposite from some people that really do have power around here, which is, what do we need to do to help? What needs to happen to facilitate the necessary changes, you know, to get us, meaning Texas A&M and you, Jimbo Fisher, out of this, to call it a rut, I think would be an understatement, right? You guys mentioned it's 12 games. Here's my thing. From the point where Jimbo held up the Orange Bowl trophy and said, we ain't done yet, which Aggies loved. And I loved it too. I want the A&M football coach, basketball coach, baseball coach, whether it's Buzz, whether it's Slosh, to stand up there and say, we're here. And you know, it's the mindset that Texas A&M embraces and likes. I'm not saying take back the quote, but live up to it when you say it. And since that time, A&M, if I'm not mistaken, is sitting at 11-11. If I'm not wrong, right? 12 games last year, 10 this year. Yeah, they're 11-11 since that time. 8-4 and 3-7. So it has been a rough skid. And out of that 11-11 are wins over Colorado, New Mexico, Sam Houston. So, you know, you can really almost go 8-11. In games that matter since that point in time. So they have hit a pretty big skid. You start looking at those numbers and they look like, you know, almost like what Dan Mullen was doing at Florida down the stretch, where I was sitting here in College Station going, golly, people are on Jimbo. Look what Mullen's doing over here. Their numbers look a lot like what Steve Sarkisian's done in Austin. I do want to throw that out there because I've been hearing it from Longhorns, and unfortunately, you know, the Aggies and Longhorns right now are in a big, giant mid-off, literally mid-off, sitting at 11-11 each since the start of last season. We're down bad here in Texas, unless you're a fan of the team in purple up in Fort Worth who's rolling.
So, Billy, I'm going to throw this scenario at you because I've talked about this on the show a little bit. Let's say that I'm one of these mega donors at A&M, and someone from the football program, could be Jimbo Fisher or someone else, comes in and says, hey, we're going to need $5 million in our collective, you know, to help maintain this great recruiting class we had last year, to see that a lot of these guys don't transfer away. And this is going to go on at every major program in the country this offseason when terms of transfer and You've got 85 free agents every single year turning over that could leave your program. But if I'm one of these donors, I'm coming back and saying, I don't really love the return on investment that's going on right now with this recruiting class. What I will do is give $5 million to hire the best offensive coordinator in America to help revamp this offense and have a quick change a year from now where the talent is there. And let's start doing something on offense. But that would require Jimbo Fisher relinquishing the offense to an offensive coordinator. What do you think about that scenario with donors?
I think that's already happened to a degree. Now, fortunately, there's plenty that are going to do the work on the collective side as well. But I think there's people have stepped up and said, hey, that's what I meant earlier when I said, we'll do what we have to do. And there's a couple of them in particular that will say, hey, we'll, whatever the coaching change side of this is, we can do that. But it's interesting because do donors need to do that at a place like Texas A&M, or can that be handled within the department, you know, athletic department funds to hire and make changes within the staff outside of the buyout of $87 million or something? And then do you say, however you can say it legally, because the school's not supposed to say it, or do you, somehow does that message go, great thought, but we don't need it in terms of making a coaching change, you know, in terms of, you know, assistants or OC in particular. Why don't we use that? That money would be better spent over here in terms of the collective. So I think those type conversations are probably had, not just at A&M, but everywhere. But in the case of the coordinator thing, I don't think there's any doubt that Jimbo has to do that. I think he will. The question is, his words across the street at this press conference every week do not inspire any level of thinking that he thinks there's anything really wrong with what they're trying to do offensively, and it's more so the execution. That bothers me when I listen to it, but I also know enough behind the scenes that I do think there's going to be a significant change in the direction of this offense moving forward. And I do think it's going to be Jimbo's decision. And by his decision, I think he's going to make that decision and decide he needs to take it in a new direction. I get that you can't sit in there, guys, for the last 6 weeks and say, yeah, our offense sucks and I don't like it, and then go into a staff meeting of offense after that. Like, it just doesn't, I don't think that's the way to do business, but I do wish Jimbo would be sitting in there, maybe not making it so convincing that he doesn't think there's that much wrong with it and that they're that close. In some weird way, you know, had A&M beaten Auburn or lost to 31-28, I think you'd be seeing a coach right now going, hey, once Connor Wigman came in, look what we did, 28 against Ole Miss, 31 against Auburn, told you this thing works. And it's not. It can, even if that were the case, it can be so much better. The talent is there for it to be so much better. And I think Jimbo Fisher, people don't agree with this, I think he's a brilliant offensive mind. I just think he needs to be pulled, you know, and he's not going to get pulled against his will. And that's the part where I think everyone's correct. He is set, dug in, and he's not going to be pulled against his will. That's why you let him make the hire. He finds somebody that he vibes with and maybe even is enamored with a little bit, like, oh man, I really enjoy talking offense with this guy during the interviews, and have someone that they can ride, that, you know, can bring him along with him into this kind of, I don't know if you say modern era, but just kind of the current way offenses seem to be succeeding around the country and even around the SEC. So that, I think, is the path to doing it. We'll see, you know, what moves Jimbo makes probably, I think, beginning in a week and a half, maybe the day after you play LSU.
Is there a name or an offense that intrigues you, Billy, that Texas A&M may target for an offensive coordinator or play caller that they could bring in at this point?
I don't know Texas A&M wise, because that's I'll find out more about that as if and when things open up and an actual search gets underway. I haven't heard specific names. Names that I would like to see are guys like, obviously, Garrett Riley's a hot name right now. Not a lot of experience behind that at TCU. I like him on a personal level. He was a GA here way back in the day when I was just getting started. And Jeff Grimes, who's at Baylor, I think his style of play fits in this league, that physicality in it. So I like what the guy at Wake Forest does. And Jimbo's had success hiring a coordinator from Wake Forest before, and Mike Elko. I like what Phil Longo is doing and has done at North Carolina. So those are just a few names. I don't know. I half expect let's just get the whole thing going in the full circus mode and go hire Bobby Petrino away from Missouri State and just, like, just go all in with the craziness and embrace it. There's no telling which way they'll go. I could even see Jimbo maybe even looking in an NFL direction. I haven't heard anything like that, but that wouldn't shock me either. I don't think that's the answer, though, because I think that just kind of sticks a little too much in the lane. And I don't expect him to go all the way. I don't expect this to be like an air raid type of move at all. In fact, I would go as far as say that ain't happening. But there's a lot between what Jimbo and A&M are doing and the air raid. And I don't know if he's going to go past 50% of there, but I'd like him to get a lot closer, you know, over there to the middle. And I think that's what you'll see him do.
Billy Lucci, TexAx.com with us. I know you're tired of the A&M and Longhorn comparisons here, but I'll at least make one more. Texas last year brings in Gary Patterson. For a short time, they were considering David Cutcliffe as well. Maybe that has to do with recruiting with the Manning. Who knows? We know Cutcliffe's with the SEC. Could we also see that where there is a friend of Jimbo Fisher that comes in as not an analyst, a consultant, a senior assistant, not offensive coordinator? You get where I'm going here. Could that also be an avenue where Jimbo Fisher, since you said it is his call, calls someone from his past to come in and help fix things?
Maybe Cutcliffe would come be your OC. I think that'd be
a good one.
Pretty nice. They don't have a quarterback this year. Maybe they get Cutcliffe and Arch Manning.
Yeah. Well, the transfer portal's
kidding.
Open. Yeah.
By I'm the way, Texas fans are going to hear that and love that them. One. Yeah.
I just want to upset them. No, that was never even an option. But I think everything's on the table.
Okay.
And I would love to see Jimbo get one of those guys. You know, I read the article in The Athletic the other day. How do you even say his name? The guy that just got named the head coach at Charlotte today, or rumored to be taking it or whatever. Pogi,
I think.
I can barely say your last name.
P-O-G-G-I, right? I think it's Pogi.
Yeah. So that article was pretty interesting about, you know, how that kind of, he was such a life preserver there for Jim Harbaugh, who was essentially drowning, and they had a similar. You look at looking for a comparison. That is one. You can also look at Notre Dame with how Brian Kelly had to reinvent himself after that year they went, I believe, maybe 4-8. Now the difference is Kelly had a lot of sustained success there at Notre Dame prior to that. He had taken them to a national title game, but there are similarities in Kelly at Notre Dame, Harbaugh, and what Jimbo's going through here. I would love to see him. Like you mentioned, Cutcliffe, and again, I haven't heard anything about that name, but. Like a guy like that, that I think Jimbo Fisher could sit down with, you know, at some point every single day and just shut the door and talk. And a guy that could be perfectly honest with him, brutally honest if need be, but also just on the same level of just talking like, hey, what are you seeing? You're new here. What do you see? Talk to me. And who knows? I mean, I would love to see that. I think A&M would create that position if Jimbo wanted it. I just don't know if there's any desire on his part to have that or to go down that road.
I'm not trying to make the last 5 weeks impact the next 5 years, but how much has LSU's resurgence impacted A&M's chance at grabbing the mantle that we expected them to grab this preseason?
Oh, I think it affects it big time because Brian Kelly and his I never thought, and you guys probably didn't either. I know the people in Louisiana didn't even, that Ed O was going to last and that success was going to be sustained. I never was that scared of Les Miles, even though he was beating A&M. I mean, they were losing typically three games minimum a year, with the exception, obviously, of, you know, but from when A&M joined the SEC, LSU sitting on two losses. If they lose another game, and look, they've done a hell of a job, but they've lost two games or more. I mean, they've lost three games minimum every year since A&M joined the SEC in 2012, except one, which was obviously one of the best years we've ever seen. Brian Kelly, I think his low years are going to be you know, the 9-3 type seasons. I'm not saying he's going to go win multiple titles there, but he's going to turn them into a national title contending program in pretty short order. His track record says he is. And that place, unlike A&M, where you have to build up, A&M reminds me of like more like Clemson and what Dabo did, where you have to build it up and then you can sustain it. But you got to have 3 years of really high success for it to just roll. USC, Texas, Michigan, Ohio, or you know, the teams that are down a little bit, USC, Miami, even not maybe not so much Tennessee, but LSU is certainly one of those where like 1 year you can ride that in the momentum and what you can do in that state and what they can do now via NIL. People want LSU to be good. Recruits want them to be good. So for it to hit the way it has in year one, especially after losing two games, and for Kelly to do, I mean, Kelly to do that in the year that this, if you're an Aggie fan, you go, if Texas A&M was 80% of what not just people here in College Station, but all around the country thought they were going to be, if A&M was the 12th best team in college football right now, they'd probably be playing LSU for the SEC West title. Obviously, they're nowhere near that. But if they were preseason number six, if they were the 12th best team this year, because the teams they've played have not been that good. And they came 2 yards from beating Alabama. And part of that was they didn't have to play the Heisman Trophy winner. It was one of the biggest breaks of all time. If this was a top 15 team or so, they're probably sitting at 9-1 or 8-2 right now. And that's a shame. That's such a wasted opportunity for this program. And here's the thing now. You missed your window. You can get back in the window, but now you got company because LSU is not going anywhere. So that's what I would say the last 5 weeks have meant is you could have kept your momentum rolling and said, oh, man, it sucks that you guys are here, but I guess you can be here with us. Now A&M's got to climb back up and kick that door in again. I don't think LSU necessarily keeps A&M from doing that, but the Aggies had such a head start there that they let just completely get away from them. So fortunately for them, neither Oklahoma nor Texas are taking advantage of this either.
Billy, last thing for you. Please tell me that Moose Muhammad was not benched because he decided to wear sleeves, and that's the only reason that he didn't play on Saturday night. Are you serious?
I think he was. Yeah. I mean, he tweeted it. He said it. And I heard that during the game. Someone texted it to me. I didn't even believe it.
Was there an outburst associated with it? I keep thinking there has to be more of a backstory to where there was like an outward defiant attitude the week of or going into it. And then he came out in the sleeves and there was a fight. But it was just as simple as he wanted to wear sleeves and he couldn't.
To the best of my knowledge, and I could be wrong on some small detail here, but I've asked a lot of people, and it sounded like in pregame, I don't know if that was in the locker room or if that was out there on the field, the skill guys were told, hey, no sleeves out here tonight. I think it had to do with the weather. I think Moose had muffed a punt against South Carolina with them. And it's kind of been a thing that Jimbo has done at times dating back. I've talked to somebody that's been with him since his days at Florida State. And he said, no sleeves. And it's ball security related for the skill guys. And all of them, you know, I don't know who had them on and took them off or who already didn't have them, but none of them wore sleeves. And he refused. He said it on his own Twitter. He thought it helped him for protection and performance purposes. And he wasn't going to play without them. And I got a lot of questions like, why is he still on the sideline? I think it was as simple as I did hear from some people that observed it. And I think he was on the opening kickoff or something. And there was a confrontation on the sideline about it between he and Jimbo and receivers coach James Coley. I know a couple of players, at least a couple that went up and were kind of imploring him to take him off. He didn't want to take him off. I think if he'd have taken him off after one drive or two or in the third quarter or whenever, as soon as he took him off, I don't know this, but I'm pretty sure that was why he was out there. As soon as he took him off, he could go out there and play. I just felt like the whole thing is such a distraction. The camera keeps cutting over there, and you just didn't want to explain any of it to the booth. So TV could have just said, you know, what it was. And I get that Jimbo's trying to keep things in house, but to not address it yesterday in a presser when the kids got it out on Twitter, you're not protecting him from anything. And I think it's just, hey, I'm the head coach. I'm going to discipline my team. My decision for ball security purposes was I didn't want them wearing sleeves in that condition. He decided he didn't want to take them off. He's not going to play with them. That's my decision. I don't think on his part that's micromanaging. I think Brian Kelly would do that. I think Nick Saban would do that. I just wonder why you just don't say, somebody, don't let him back out here unless he comes out here without sleeves. Or in the presser, just to explain it as such. Like, hey, I'm disciplining my guys. I'm going to continue to do that. And we've discussed it. It's all good. He didn't play this week. He'll play next week or whatever it is. But, guys, you know this. This is just what happens when you're losing a lot of football games and you're losing six games in a row and it feels like the wheels have come off. These type things only happen when things are going that way on the field. Am I right?
No doubt about it.
It flows to the top of the surface for sure. Billy Lucci, yeah, all over it as always. Follow him on Twitter at Billy Lucci. Better yet, just go to texags.com. And the next time you're in Nashville, Billy, we've got any flavor of moonshine you want.
Got these cherries for you here, Billy.
I'll pack it up and send it
your
way.
Got your name on it. Some moonshine cherries for
you. We always appreciate you. We'll see you soon.
I'm coming to Nashville. I'm going to make a trip, and we're going to have some stories to tell after that trip on the next appearance.
Absolutely.
That sounds good. We'll make Clay pay for it.
Yes.
Perfect. He can.
All right, man.
Thanks, Billy.
Talk to you soon. There's Billy Lucci, always kind enough to join us. And, you know, next time he comes on, I want to ask him. We ran out of time there, Chad. I want to find out, you know, when he talks to these Texas A&M donors over dinner, the net worth of the room. Like, he's sitting in a room with how much money? Because I think it would blow your mind with the oil money that he talks to there.
Not to name drop here, but I'll always remember Billy introducing me to Johnny Football, Johnny Manziel, on the sideline with A&M driving to beat Bama in that moment. And Manziel looking at me say, hey, man, great to meet you. I'm going to check this out, though, right now. I'm like, Johnny,
you got better things.
Don't worry about it, man. I am not important right now. You get back to watching your Aggies knock off number one Alabama.
This is Outkick 360. Huge thanks to Jason Campbell, John McClain, Frank Isola, Billy Lucci. If you missed those chats, podcast always available wherever you download your audio. Just search out Outkick 360. Tonight, Chad, college football playoff rankings will be announced. That's a little bit later than usual. I think it's at 8 o'clock Central, 9 Eastern, around there at halftime of the Tuesday night tip-off on ESPN.
Champions Classic.
There
it's Kentucky-Michigan State tonight.
Thank you. Expectations about the same?
Yeah, the only change is going to be Oregon falling after the loss.
We'll see USC move up.
USC will move up slightly. UCLA will fall after their loss to Arizona. But I think 1-5 will remain exactly the same.
Any chance that TCU could bump up ahead of Michigan?
No. Well, no.
I think that would be the one surprise that I've thought of based on how they won against Texas, not scoring more than 30 and doing it the Texas way. I know TCU's defense was good. Point being, we haven't seen that type of performance and have them win. It's been a fourth quarter.
If Michigan didn't just utterly dominate Nebraska, I think maybe, but they won like 34-3 or something was the final. So that was utterly embarrassing. Brent on the YouTube chat says, Billy Lucci seems like the guy I would definitely drink a beer with. I responded and said, Hutton and I, having drank beers with Billy Lucci, can confirm. Hell of a guy to have a beer with.
And amazingly
I would advise you doing so.
Hey, enjoy the sports evening. We'll recap the college football playoff rankings tomorrow. Plenty of college football discussion to set up the weekend as well. Hope you'll join us for Outkick 360 across the Outkick Network.